of these authors, in particular Gregory Gavadet. We see here. So before I get to the science, I want to thank everyone for being here this early in light of last night. So evidently we've all learned the G8 lesson, which is to avoid long receptions with Russian colleagues. So I thought to follow up on Stefan's talk, I would bring it back perhaps with an analogy that we're more familiar with, perhaps, which is electromagnetism. So the idea is, can we find the analogy of a cosmological constant problem within the context of E&M? And to a certain extent, there is. So if you consider a uniform charge density in pure electromagnetism, that's the equivalent of a lambda term. The solution for the gauge field, in some gauge in any case, has the gauge field growing as some quadratic power of the distance, time, or whatever, which is the equivalent of the Sitter space, perturbed the Sitter space with some metric component growing as t squared. Okay, so it tells you that your gauge field grows unbounded. Which is also saying, of course, that this corresponds to an electric field that grows linearly unbounded. Okay, so in E&M, that's the equivalent of a CC problem. So there are two possible solutions to this, to cure this CC problem. One would be to give the photon a mass. Okay, that will, of course, cut off the infrared propagation of photons. But you could also follow the route that Stefan was proposing, which is to turn Maxwell's equations, give it some permeability, which acts as a filter, that's going to filter out the long wavelength sources. And I want to argue that these two are actually equivalent. So let's start with the theory of massive U1, which is Foucault theory, that's this equation. And as was pointed out earlier, this doesn't look manifestly gauge invariant because of the explicit dependence on the gauge field in that equation. But that's of course a red herring. There's no such thing as breaking gauge invariance. So you can always restore gauge invariance by including a slipover field as such. So what you do is you write your vector field, which has three polarization, as two helicity one polarizations, those are the usual Maxwellian degrees of freedom, plus a scalar part, the longitudinal component of your vector field, which is the Goldstone. Now, under gauge transformations, the Maxwellian dip transforms as usual, whereas the Goldstone transforms in this way, such that the combination of the two is gauge invariant. Okay, so that's how this equation is actually manifested gauge invariant. And as was pointed out earlier, this is a cool observation, because it tells you that the full vector field is actually gauge invariant, which makes it an observable. Okay, so in Prokhorov theory, you can actually measure the gauge field itself. So how does that solve the so-called CC problem in E&M? Well, the way it does it, let me actually show you the equivalent first. So if I take this decomposition and just substitute it in the Prokhorov equation, the first term is invariant in the sense that whether I write twiddle or not doesn't matter, because f mu is gauge invariant by construction. And then the mass term will split as these two components. By taking the divergence of this equation, so I'm basically following step by step what Stefan was doing in the case of gravity, if I take the divergence of that equation, the first term vanishes by the Bianchi identity. That's just an identity. And so you're left with an equation that I can rewrite as an equation for the Goldstone itself. Okay, so the Goldstone, as you see, couples to the longitudinal component of the term. And I can solve for the Goldstone, solve that equation, and plug that back into this equation, play a little bit around with it, so I get an equation for the helicity one piece, which is this one. Okay, so you end up with a theory that looks like a filter equation for the gauge, for the helicity one piece. Okay, so this argument shows that whether I add a mass or I postulate some filtering mechanism, those two things are precisely equivalent. Are there any questions about that?
I got a question.
Yes.
If you did have this in electromagnetism, would this give rise to rotation, polarization, and these time and time field experiments? Or have you not read about it?
Well, I don't think so, right? Because this is actually, this, are you worried that the longitudinal bit could bubble to spin?
No. Are you thinking like a PVLAS experiment kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. But now you're coupling to a scale of fields, you're propagating degrees of freedom, you're propagating degrees of freedom, and moving to slightly different velocities.
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't thought of that.
So 30 degrees of freedom propagating the same velocity and doesn't couple to matter in the case of photon. In the case of gravity, it's different.
Yeah, that's true. So this guy actually decouples for conserved forces. So adding this last, I want to argue, solves the CC problem in a trivial sense, in that if you look at that equation for Proca with my uniform charge density, then the trivial solution to that equation is for the gauge field to be some constant, and that's it. Okay, so that, of course, has zero electric field. But now you'll understand from known physics what this is. What we've done by turning on a mass for the photon is make a vacuum superconducting. So as you know, the superconductor, if you put a charge, there's screening. So the light scale larger than n inverse, charges get screened. So that's the idea we're using here. So a uniform source will get screened in the vacuum. So that's the idea we want to use, that the degradation of the cosmological constant is analogous to the screening of charges in the Higgs phase of Maxwell theory. This we want to think of the gravitation as some Higgs phase of gravity. There's a question to that.
By solves the cosmological constant problem, you don't mean you're addressing the small value, you just mean that you're...
But you pointed this out earlier, so that's a good question. Let me address that. Let me just answer that. So that's a good question. Now, there's a key difference. Of course, at a naive level, you're making a parameter small by either lambda or the mass of the gauge field. But the question is not whether you're making a number small, it's whether it's UV sensitive or not. So making the CC small is a UV sensitive thing to do. You put it to zero, you calculate loops, it comes back in constant as Stefan showed you explicitly. But if you make the mass of the gauge field small, that's UV insensitive. Because if you set it to zero, you get gauge invariance. And you calculate loops, you're not going to generate that. So it's a tuning in the sense you're putting the number small, but it's a UV insensitive tuning.
But in the sense that not much constant problem is a fine-tuning problem. So do you have any fine-tuning?
Well, that's the answer I just gave. In the sense that
I'm asking it.
Let me say it differently. That was just a scare line. Let me put it just to find the race. Sorry, not to reiterate what I said, but let me just say just a little bit differently. The point is the following, right? So what you have in normal gravity, you have Einstein-Hilbert, then you have a lambda, and then we're adding a mass term. Let me just write it schematically like this. So this term we know. This term we have no control over. Completely UV sensitive. Okay, so making this guy small is completely fine tuning. What I'm saying is that instead we're making this guy small, which is UV insensitive. And then by filtering the smallness of this, I argue make this guy small. Okay, that's the rough argument. But I'm glad you point this out. That's a crucial point of this whole program.
So what, for example, in this, if you just sort of, naively sort of apply this idea to gravity, then it seems that you can just screen the standard density, just not the cosmological constant, but just, say, matter density.
Ah, no, so good. So that's a very good question. So let me move to gravity, and then we'll see exactly what gets screened. Okay? So that's an excellent question. So now I just want to basically... review in a few steps, just to refresh our memory, what happens with gravity analogously. So again, I just want to briefly argue that the gravitation is explicitly equivalent to adding a mass, or making the graviton a massive particle or a resonance. Okay? So the only consistent theory of linearized spin 2 particle, massive spin 2, is Peart-Spalding. And there it is, where we're just making the master now a function of balls. Okay, and as Stepan argued, there are unitary constraints on what that function is, but for the time being, let's just take it as some function. Okay? Where again, this epsilon is the linearized Einstein tensor. Now again, you restore gauge into what looks like broken diff invariance, you restore it by including supervert. So here, we've naively broken four diffs, so you have to add a vector work of supervert. So it's a vector amu that you add to this. And this h hat and the amu, they shift. So the h hat is like the Einstein part of the metric. So it shifts under diffs as the Einstein metric. And meanwhile, your gauge field shifts appropriately so that the sum of the two, so that this guy is gauge invariant. Okay, so the physical metric in Peart-Spalding is actually gauge invariant. It's a physical observable. So in principle, in such a theory, you could tell, let's say, how many peoples of inflation there was. You can actually go measure the metric, and you know what's happened in the past. Okay. So then the point is that what you do is we rewrite that Peart-Spalding equation in terms, we want to write it in terms of h hat, integrating out the gauge field, integrating out the Stueckelberg. So we do that, you substitute, you find an equation for the Stueckelberg, plug it back in, and at the end of the day, you get this this filtering equation for the Einstein part, the Hilbert 2 part of the metric. Now, to answer a question that was asked earlier about the sort of non-local form of this, that's not so surprising in some sense because we've integrated out the Stueckelberg. So it looks non-local because we've integrated out certain degrees of freedom.
In this case, you sort of interpret this H-twiddle as the metric progression.
That H-twiddle is only part of the full metric.
Yeah, from the original formulation. But if you start from here.
Right, so the lesson, okay, so let me turn that around. Yeah. The lesson is that should you write such a theory, should you write this as your theory of modified gravity, that would be an inconsistent theory. There would be a ghost in that theory. Because at the linearized level, I can choose some gauge and write it as a theory of massive gravity for only 2 degrees of freedom, and you know that's impossible. That's the lesson you guess the next part, which is, okay, so that's a statement that it's a theory of massive or resonance gravity, and therefore that you have to have these extra degrees of freedom. Okay, and unlike the gauge theory, where, so these are two Einstein parts, these guys we don't care, and the Hilbert zero guy is the one that's important. So unlike ENM, and what we're discussing, in ENM, the Goldstone decouples. So you can just ignore it, it's conserved forces. But this guy, in gravity, plays an extremely interesting, there's an extremely interesting story associated with it. So that's the basic story.
Helicity one term decouple in the limit of the mass goes to zero. Helicity zero doesn't.
Exactly. And that's going to occupy the next few slides. So that's precisely the problem underlying the VDBZ discontinuity.
So helicity zero is the gold standard function, which is bigger than the mass.
Well, it's one of them.
It's a longitudinal.
Yeah, that's right. So that's right. So it's one of the three Stueckelbergs, so to speak. But it's the guy that doesn't decouple.
It's like the Higgs mechanism on the screen.
Yeah, that's precisely that. Yeah, exactly. So that is what we're doing is sort of the low energy Higgs gravity. Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay, so coming back to this point about the Hilbert zero, that's a crucial central element of this whole story. So let me just focus on that Hilbert zero part. So what you have is the Hilbert 2 plus the Hilbert zero, which I write as chi. Now this first bit looks like a conformal transformation at linear order, and that's just done for convenience. That's like going to Einstein frame. Okay, the term that causes trouble is this guy. Okay. The term that comes from dU, amu, but expressed in terms of chi. And now, because I'm going to Einstein frame, this guy couples to the trace of T mu nu. So it's going to contribute to the force between two particles. So at the linear level, this is like a Brand-Zwicky theory, right? I'm working in Einstein frame, and there's a coupling between a scalar with a trace of T mu u. So both of these guys have a profile 1 over R. Both the Einstein and the helicity is 0. And so the full amplitude, the exchange amplitude between two sources, it has two components. The helicity 0, the helicity 2 part, which is the one you get in Einstein gravity with the famous factor of a half. But now this guy comes in with a factor of a 6, and so gives you an extra TD prime contribution, which, as Eric said, even in the limit m goes to 0, the propagator extends to box, but then the minus a half plus a 6 is a minus a third. So there's a, at the linearized level, there's a discontinuity in the m goes to 0 limit. Okay, there's a whole rich history about this, and for 30 years, and in particular, Gregory and Sidibayev were here, played an important role in understanding this discontinuity. So the point is the following, that how do you resolve this apparent paradox is the fact that chi, this helicity zero mode, is actually not, you cannot treat it linearly around a source. It actually gets strongly coupled. You have to solve for it non-linearly. So let's put our foot on the ground just with gravity, okay? So with helicity 2-bit, let's ask, okay, you have the sun, you have the earth, you have two sources. And you ask, when are these cubic terms important? These corrections to just the, you know, one graviton exchange amplitude. Well, these guys, they become important when you reach the Schwarzschild radius of a source. That's when gravity gets nonlinear. Okay? But far away from Schwarzschild, you can just use linearized gravity, and that's fine. The problem with chi is that it actually gets strongly coupled at much longer distances than Schwarzschild. So for it, if you like, there's another Schwarzschild radius, so to speak, which we call R star. And that's the scale at which these nonlinear interactions for chi become relevant. And you have to sum them up.
But you don't have the nonlinear theory, so how do you know about them, right?
So the leading, so I'll show that to you a little bit later on in the talk, but you can extract the leading contribution to this nonlinear behavior.
So in the previous slide, you just had this one of the box where there's no alpha or whatever. Mm-hmm. Now you assume alpha to be
very good, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's good. So before I was using this this general formula m squared box, and now I'm going to use this parameterization that Stefan used, which I might just write on the board to refresh everyone's memory. So this is the form it takes in the V by R. So the infrared, it's L to the minus 2, box to the alpha. Okay. So we'll just, we're only concerned about the V by R behavior. Okay, so I've just explicitly written it down here. So this R star is given by, in fact, some geometric product between the Schwarzschild radius and this Compton wavelength, the graviton. This is like Hubble radius today. Okay, so this is far greater than the Schwarzschild radius. And it depends.
Oh, alpha not equal to 1.
So we're working, yeah. Theories with alpha greater than a half are already ruled out. So if you like, the theories of interest have alpha equals a half or smaller.
So when is that alpha equals 1/2?
Okay. Just hold on for a second. These are good questions. So here the picture, the same story but in the picture. So if you have a source like the sun, one length scale is the Compton wavelength of the graviton, that's Hubble today. So if you imagine being out here very far away from the sun, you would find that both components of the metric goes as 1/r. Okay, so linear theory holds very far. But as you approach the source, eventually you hit a scale, which is this R star radius, which is extremely large. So for the sun and mass of gravity, it's whatever, 10 to the 16 kilometers. So it's huge, okay, well beyond the solar system. You have this R star. And within R star, what you find is chi is strongly coupled, so you solve for it nonlinearly, and you find that, in fact, what happens is that it actually goes as R over R star to some positive power. it's strongly coupled, when you solve for it, its contribution is actually suppressed compared to 1 over r. It suppresses powers of r over r star. So within the solar system, for example, this guy is completely decoupled. Okay. Makes very small contribution. Okay, so this is a funny theory, just to drive that point home. This is a funny theory in the sense that at the linearized level, at the perturbative level, you get order 1 corrections from general relativity. Okay? But non-perturbatively, when you sum up these nonlinear interactions, that's how you get the limit which is close to GR. So in other words, for r much less than r star, you get that chi is some power law of r over r star, where the power depends on alpha. Okay? Yes.
So you don't understand how you sum up this if you don't have a nonlinear theory.
Yeah, so, okay, so very good. So I'll show you. So there are two statements to that. Okay, so one is there's an explicit model of a nonlinear extension to that, which is DGP. That turns out to correspond to alpha is a half. So there, Cedric and Gregory have shown explicitly that this is precisely the behavior. Okay, that's a full theory, so you can solve it classically. In massive gravity, you don't have a nonlinear theory for that. But what you can do is you can extract, I'll show that a bit later, you can extract the dominant self-interaction of chi, okay, in a certain limit. And it's that dominant interaction that I use to derive that suppression. Okay?
Justin, thanks a lot for that, but I don't think I'm on the paper, so it's good enough for the second one.
Sorry, okay. The general rule is you put food in the audience as frequently as possible. Every one of your slides. John.
Yeah, if you're saying that for 100 parsecs, if you start getting nonlinear gravity,
yeah.
10 to 50 kilos is about 100 parsecs. So okay. If I'm sitting inside a dwarf galaxy, inside a galaxy,
yeah.
Then they go out to 100 parsecs. So when I get out there, if I apply myself for the velocity dispersion of the dwarf galaxy, I use it to only gravity.
Yes.
So what happens when I get to 100 parsecs in the sensor?
So you'll get an extra force in this.
No, but that's not what I see observationally.
No.
When you solve for the velocity dispersion, you have to be close to you. Also probably the forces.
So don't you infer dark matter? Don't you infer dark matter in these objects?
Can't have you break down 100 parsecs.
You say that is true. However, before you get to 100 parsecs, there is other stuff entering that radius, so the disaster still grows even further. So eventually, you end up having in the real universe, you'll end up having R star to be more than tens of megaparsecs or something like that.
How do you predict something? How do I do a calculation?
Oh, there is a way to do
that. I have to know how to do this.
No, you can do expansion in this small graviton mass, for instance, for that purpose. And you will see what the corrections, how long the corrections are. Or you can solve exactly if you can.
So there is no general
This behavior?
Right.
Yeah, this is based on it's been checked in the full non example, and for other theories, it's based on this dominant nonlinear behavior.
There's no generalism to mention. Again, generalism by the alpha?
I think that all I can say is the answer I just gave you. That is to say, you can extract the dominant nonlinear bit in some limit, and then there are corrections to that answer. So for any alpha.
So you're saying for alpha larger than 1/2 is already ruled that alpha is smaller.
Yeah, so I was going to get to that. Yeah, good, thank you. So even in the solar system, I said it was 10 to the 16 or whatever it is. Well, that depends on alpha, but whatever that long distance is, still, let's just take the Earth, still at the distance of the moon, there is going to be a small correction to what you would have in GR. And that's tested in laser ranging of the moon's orbit. And so, indeed, that correction, so I hope this is quoted right. Alpha bigger than 1/2, I believe, is already ruled out to some significance. Alpha is 1/2, I just took from this paper, outputs that have will be tested in the next few years. And these theories of outputs that have are beyond the expected accuracy. Okay?
Is there discontinuing that alpha?
No, it's just that, no, it's like whatever, right? I mean, no, it's not discontinuous, it's just that this is a sensitive function of that, of this effect. Maybe it's 0.5 alpha. Okay, the point is that, okay, so for r bigger than r star, the theory becomes linear again, and you have 1 over r behavior. So let's get back to this degradation mechanism. What are the implications of that lesson? Okay, for the degradation story. So what I've told you is we had this effective equation, which was this, but only for the infinity 2 part. Okay, there were extra degrees of freedom. So one question we want to address is, in what regime is this equation valid for the full degrees of freedom, the full metric? So as long as, so for the universe, what plays a role of Schwarzschild radius is the Hubble radius. So as long as Hubble is much less than the constant wavelength of the universe, of the graviton, that is to say, at early times when the universe is small, the universe is well within its own R star. So that if you solve for chi, it's actually suppressed in the way that I've said. Okay? So in that regime, the full metric, which was helicity 2 plus helicity 0, the helicity 0 bit is completely negligible, and what you get is that the two, helicity 2 and the full metric are basically the same. And so you can really trust this degravitational story. So in other words, even for the full metric, at early times, we expect the gravitational to take place. However, at some point, the universe, the Hubble radius is growing. At some point, it's going to reach this scale, which is today, when radius becomes that of Hubble today. And then chi no longer decouples. It becomes this scalar tensor theory. So then we don't know exactly what happens in that transition region between the nonlinear and the linear regime. But our wishful thinking is that at that point, gravitation would stop. Okay? So that potentially, this is a speculation, potentially could leave you with an effective undegravitated vacuum energy of order down to the minus 2, which is Hubble today in this framework. Okay. So are there any questions about this part?
By the way, so this again about this apparent alpha. So alpha equals 0 corresponds to the n square constant?
Mm-hmm. Right. So alpha equals 0 are theories that approximate massive gravity in the integral. Very good. So now, so that's going to go to some extent to answering this question about how do we know this nonlinear behavior for chi. So one limit you can take of the theory is to take the so-called decoupling limit. Because there's a regime where chi is strongly coupled, whereas gravity is linear, you can expect that you can take some limit that's going to focus on the nonlinearities of chi. So that limit corresponds, you basically take the mass of the graviton to zero, send that scale to infinity. You decouple gravity by sending N' to infinity, but you keep this strong coupling scale, the scale of strong interactions for chi, you keep it fixed. That's like keeping that fixed is equivalent to keeping R star fixed for any source. Okay, so you send N to zero, but you keep the scale of nonlinearity around the source, you keep that fixed. So that really zooms in on chi. So the equations in that limit reduce to this. So you get your linear Einstein gravity piece, and the equation for chi, which has this nonlinear term, which I write schematically of this form, but these are terms of that form. What matters here is just the number of derivatives acting on chi. So if you ignore for a second, so we want to explore what happens with the gravitation in this limit where we're tracking a little bit of the nonlinearity, namely those of chi. So if you ignore these nonlinear terms for a moment, then the solution to these equations with some lambda are given by these, right? For the helicity 2 and helicity 0. And so the full metric, if you add those up, these two terms actually cancel in that explicit expression for the metric. So what you end up with is a flat is a flat full metric. Okay, so it seems that the gravitation seems to hold in that decoupling, limit. Now, what about these nonlinear terms? Can they come and spoil this argument? And clearly that's going to depend on the power here. Okay, so if I apply box on chi here, I get a constant. So I'm only going to get that this is zero if alpha is less than a half. So there's a positive power of derivatives acting on this constant. So from that argument, you get that at least in this decoupling limit, for the gravitation to have a chance to hold, you need to have alpha less than a half. All right. Now, whether the decoupling limit captures the dynamics of the full theory, that's in DGP, to a large extent it does. Whether in general that's true, I don't know. But it's suggested that you need alpha less than.
I think it's perhaps almost very effective on linear term.
Right. So in this equation, so the Fierce Pauli term, although it looks, okay, so that's an excellent question. So let me try and answer it. So the Fierce Pauli term looks linear in the physical metric. But if you look in terms of the Goldstone, you can keep the Goldstone to quadratic order, to this sky field. And so this term comes from the nonlinear piece of the in the Fierce Pauli term. Well, right, that would be a massive gravity, and here that's a naive extension to more general alpha theories. So the summary thus far, at this point, is that we've parameterized our infrared behavior for the mass term as some power law, box to the alpha. And unitarity, or absence of ghosts, already constrained this power to be between 0 and 1. And the potential for decoupling, for the gravitation to hold even in the decoupling limit, constrains us to alpha less than a half. So at this point, the question is, can we find, so I've mentioned alpha is a half, is a known model. Can we find these theories that lie in this interesting region? So here, let me make one statement, which is that these theories with, you know, fractional powers of box, they imply that there's some continuum, that the graviton is a resonance, so there's a continuum of gravitons in the theory. So that immediately leads you to theories with infinite large extra dimensions. So we want to look for realizations of these theories in brain world type constructions. So let me start with the well-known example of the DGP model, where we live on this brain, and there is so all the standard model particles live on this brain, but there's an infinite extra dimension, literally infinite in volume, that runs orthogonal to it. So this theory, I'm sure it's familiar to most of you, but it's a theory where even though there's an infinite extra dimension, the way you reproduce 4D gravity, at least on small scales, is by adding an explicit Ricci term on the brain. Okay, so you're confining gravity by giving it some large inertia along the brain. So there are two Planck scales in this model. And again, because the extra dimension is infinite in extent, there is no zero mode, there is no massless graviton in this theory. But the graviton is a continuum, it's a resonance of an infinite number of kk modes with characteristic width set by the ratio of these two Planck scales. And that number is set to be Hubble today, that ratio of scales. Okay, so for all purposes, the graviton is essentially massless, but it has, strictly speaking, a width of that order. At the linearized level, this theory looks like the following. So it precisely takes the form of a Pierce-Pauli theory, where you recognize from the earlier form that this is alpha is a half. These theories, at least at the linearized level, they reduce to the theory of the form I was discussing earlier.
But are those 5D equations or 4D?
These are 4D equations, thank you. So these are obtained by doing an effective theory on the brain for the metric that's on the brain, that's that edge. Thanks. And the non-locality, the fractional power of this represents the continuum of both gravitons. Okay? So at the linearized level, this theory does take the form of degravitation, which is what we were, which is what you want. But we know that at the nonlinear level, it fails in DGP. So in the DGP model, if you, you can work out, as was done by Sidney, that's correct, right? That's you? Okay. this time I got it right. So Sidney worked out this Freeman equation on the brain. Starting from the 5D equations, using the Israel junction condition, you can derive this equation. The point about this equation is it's local on the brain. If you put some large CC as your energy density, you get a large Hubble in return. Okay? So there's no degravitation at the nonlinear level in this model. But in some sense, it's consistent with what I said earlier, that alpha is a half of the borderline case that you could degravitate it, at least in the decoupling limit. So it's consistent that alpha is a half. Now, what you want is to go to higher codimension. And the claim I want to make is that all models with higher codimension brain have alpha, which is a zero, either approximately zero or exactly zero. So the argument goes as follows. There's a quick proof that I just want to walk you through. So in general, the potential between two sources is given by the integral over the spectral density, the density of states, times the Yukawa profile. So each massive graviton contributes a Yukawa contribution to the force. Where the spectral density is given in terms of the propagator in the usual way of the spectral representation. So we want to make some statements about how this density of states behave in the long wavelength limit. So at large distances in these theories, what you have is gravity, so I should say gravity at small distances is 40. But then at large distances, it takes the form of the embedding space, right? Whatever, it's going to be 1 over r to the n plus 1, where n is the codimension of the object. So in the codimension 1 case, you get 5d gravity at large distances. If it's a codimension 2 object, you'll get 1 over r cubed, as in 6d gravity, and so on and so forth. So that's the behavior at long distances. And by inspection, if you look at this expression, you guess that at least for small s, the density, the spectral density grows as some power of s given by this. Yes, so n here is the codimension of the object. So DGP n is 1. Oh, sorry, you mean this? Yes, so this transition occurs for distances which is bigger than L, which is Hubble today. Okay. So, yeah, we put it, by choosing L to be Hubble today, we're making gravity 1 over r squared, all within the universe. Exactly. Very good. So, that's the behavior, and from this, you can infer that. So the small s behavior is equivalent to the long wavelength behavior, which is equivalent to the small box limit of this expression. So you look, I'm going through this pretty quickly, but the basic argument is you look at the behavior of the spectral representation in the limit of small box. Okay? So in the limit of small box, the master dominates, and then here you get some formal expression. The point is that the limit on this side, the limit as the box goes to zero, is finite for all n bigger than 2. Okay. So all n bigger than 2 correspond to alpha is exactly 0. Okay, so all theories of n bigger than 2 in the far infrared, they approximate massive gravity. Whereas for n equals 2, that's a bit of a borderline case, you get a log divergence on this side. So log divergence doesn't, of course, is not a power law expression, but it corresponds to roughly alpha is zero spiritually. Okay, so that's the proof. So we want to look at these higher codimension DGP models to build these nonlinear theories of degravitation. So the first simple example is codimension 2 case. So very pictorially, okay, we live on a string where in a 6D bulk. And again, I'm going to put some Ricci term on the string. And then, of course, the bulk Ricci out there. There are two issues for codimension 2 or higher objects. Those issues are well known and have been well studied. The first is that if you ask for the propagator between two points, as you take the limit that these two points are going to the brain-to-brain propagator, that propagator blows up formally. So what you have to do is you have to make the brain a little bit thick. You have to regulate this divergence. So the thickness of your defect is parameterized by lambda. Formally, the propagator blows up logarithmically with the cutoff. So in the limit that you send the cutoff to infinity, that divergence. Okay, so you have to regulate somehow. And the second issue, which is a more subtle one, has to do with the fact that if you just write down the naive DGP action, what you would have written down for this case is an R6 term plus an R4 term on the string. That theory actually leads to a ghost. Okay, and I'll have more to say about this a bit later. And these are the authors that have studied this problem. So now I want to move on to a construction which goes some ways in addressing these issues. Okay, so this is recent work with this largest collaboration ever. So the idea is to do this, what we call cascading DGP. And the idea is you basically put a brain on a brain. Okay, so you put a codimension 2 object on a codimension 1 brain. And each of them has its own DGP term. Okay, so you give, roughly you'll give this guy an R4, the codimension 1 object will get an R5, and there's going to be an R6 involved. And we live, strictly speaking, of course, on the codimension 2 object. So the cool features about this, as I've argued, is that if you do that, the brain-to-brain propagator, you basically regulate this log divergence that I showed earlier. So in this context, the fact that you're putting your codimension 2 object on the codimension 1 cures that log divergence. And furthermore, although this took us 5 months to figure out, when you carefully treat it, the model also cures this ghost instability that I mentioned on the previous transparency.
What did you carefully mean?
Yeah, 5 months. That's what it is. So, let me talk about the first point, which is this regularity of the propagator. So the propagator, in this case, turns out to be this complicated function of momentum. That's the force between, or the potential between, two points on the brain. Now, it looks like there's a maximum momentum, but that's not true. For momentum large enough, you go to the analytic continuation of this function. So the tanh becomes a tanh, whatever. Okay. And what appears here is this L6. So here there are three Planck scales, so you can build up two crossover scales. And this is the crossover scale from 6 to 5. Okay? We call it L6. So at long wavelengths, if you take the p goes to 0 limit of that expression, you get a propagator that behaves like a log. Okay? That's consistent that this is indeed a codimension 1 object. So at long wavelengths, you don't see the codimension 1 object, you just see like the codimension 2. Okay, so you get the usual log behavior for codimension 2, and that indeed corresponds to alpha is approximately 0, like in the earlier analysis that I gave you. But if you compare with the pure codimension 2 case that I mentioned earlier, you can see that this logarithmic behavior is the same, except that what used to be a regularization by putting the brain to be a little bit thick, here it's being played by this L6 scale. So we haven't made, the brain so far is infinitely thin, but the regularization comes about because of this, the presence of the codimension 1 object. So now this ghost story that was asked about. So let me be a bit explicit about what happens. So if you do the naive thing again, which is to put an R6, an R5, and an R4 term on each of the relevant defects, that will be the sort of naive extension to what DGP did. You can do that, and you find that the exchange amplitude between two sources is given by this expression. So the first coefficient, whatever, this propagator is what I showed you, the complicated function on the previous transparency. The point is that you get, the point is to focus on the tensor structure. So you get a third, which is what you have in massive gravity, but then you get an extra contribution, from the extra scalar. So here, you're co-dimension two, so to speak. So there's an extra scalar on top of the massive graviton. And that extra scalar gives you this extra contribution to the exchange amplitude. The problem is that this function f of box actually goes to zero. And so you cannot define for it a well-defined spectral representation. In other words, the fact that this is not positive definite by the function of momentum means there's a growth here. There's some regime of momentum where there's a growth-like instability.
Are these plus scales arbitrary, or there is some certain orders in the scales, and 6 and 5?
Very good. So, of course, M4 is M4.
Yeah.
And M5, I believe you can play with it. M6. So M6 ultimately is what plays the role of the. So M6 is the one that ends up being what the L is if you look at it carefully. Yeah. So M6, that's another cool thing also true in co-dimension 2, is that what plays the role of this L let me write it L minus 2. Is M6 to the 4 over M4 squared. So that's cool. The reason is, let me write it differently. Yeah, let me take the square root. If this is Hubble, then it tells you that M6 is a millimeter inverse. Okay, so that's a cool, particular cool thing about co-dimension 2 story, is that the ballpoint scale is a millimeter inverse.
But M5,
you can play with it too. It's a free for. So that's one pathology. But a related pathology is that the trace. So although before I was telling you the brain-to-brain propagator was regulated, that's true for the only part of the metric. Okay, for the full metric components, there is still one component that diverges. If you like, the trace of the metric still has this log divergence. So you still have to regulate the brain somehow, and this is, in fact, doing, that's what I meant by carefully, as I'll show you in a second. If you do that carefully, we believe, you actually solve both problems in one shot. You get rid of the ghost, and you get a fully regular theory. So let me explain to you in the last few minutes that I have. So how do we cure the ghost? You have to regulate your defects. So let's make them a little bit thick. Okay, so crudely speaking, we make both the co-dimension 1 object and the co-dimension 2 a little bit thick. We give them thicknesses delta, big delta, and small delta. Now the key insight is that, so now you want to add your DGP terms to that. The key insight is that once you've made something thick, okay, you have to put a DGP term that is correspondent to the dimensionality of your object. In other words, if I start with a four-dimensional space, and all of a sudden I make it slightly five-dimensional, I cannot put an R4 on that thing meaningfully, right? Where do you put the R4 on that object? Okay, so you put the Ricci term that's correspondent to the space-time dimensions of your defects. So, in this case, we've made everything thick, so everything is six-dimensional by a little bit. So, we follow prescription in some sense of that was proposed earlier by these authors, which is you're basically thinking of your brain as gravitational, as having a non-trivial gravitational permeability. Okay, so you give them R6s, like this, for the two objects, but with slightly different permeability. And I'll show you that this is precisely equivalent, almost equivalent to doing just DGP. So the point is the following. In the limit that you take their thickness to zero, you would expect that still, you wouldn't care about the details of the regularization. So you take the thin brain limit, and you expect you can do meaningfully some KK reduction, some dimensional reduction, as you take the thin brain limit. So in other words, what we want to do is you take these terms, okay, and you do a KK reduction only within the word volume of these defects to get some effective theory in the thin brain limit. So here's how it works. So you take one of the objects, and you just do KK reduction within it. You just write your metric as, this is the 4D metric, plus your moduli.
What kind of algorithms do you use on those two sides of the, you have some thickness?
Yeah, right, so you have to be, you just have to be careful, right? So these are, there's a non-trivial permeability, right? So you'll have to take, there's going to be a jump in the extrinsic curvature.
So you do make it so.
Yeah, you have to be very careful about how you treat them. Metric will be continuous, and so but it's just, I mean, at the detailed level, it's nothing more than KK.
But when you're breaking gauge invariance, because you're fixing some coordinates.
So, of course, how to say this? It's nothing more like that KK when you're doing a circle. You choose some ansatz on which you reduce. And that's what we're doing here. But the final action, no, that's a good question, so let me try to address it. But the final action, the point is that the thin gray limit, these are scalar fields. Okay. So each term in the effective action will be gauge in there.
Okay. So you have some boundaries there, right? And that delta is small.
Yes.
And those boundaries could have dynamics.
Oh yeah, okay, so that's good. Right. So these, yeah, so up here so far that was, yeah. But then I choose some coordinate choice where, let's say, one brain lies at z equals 0, and the other guy, and so on and so forth. And I use that to do the KK reductions. Yeah, you have to make that choice to do the KK reductions. So if you do that, and then you take the thin brain limit, because you started with R6 terms, you're going to get extra couplings. So here are the new brain terms. Instead of having just R5, now you have R5 times some function of the scalar field. Okay, so you get some scalar tensor theory. And similarly on the R4 brain, you also have these extra couplings to the two scalars. And as you know now, because you have these extra couplings, what that tells you is that you have extra brand Zipf-like scalars in the theory. And those are going to come and mediate extra forces. So that, as you know from Brand Sticky, these guys contribute to the trace part of the amplitude. And when you include them, you indeed recover, instead of the complicated form I had earlier, which was this, the third plus this complicated function, you just get a fourth. Okay, and a fourth is the tensor structure you get in 6D gravity. Okay, so when you've done that properly, what that tells you is you get the tensor structure of either 6D gravity in this case, or if it's higher co-dimension, you get whatever tensor structure of the largest number of dimensions. This is a bit like the R6. This is closely related to the R6 prescription. And this theory now becomes both free because of the naive counting that minus a fourth is minus a third, which is the mass of gravity, plus an extra scalar, which is a 12th. But the plus is crucial, so that's the normal Brand Zipf-like scalar. Now you might say, oh, big deal, you still have to regularize this thing, so what did this cascading story help you with? But the cool thing is that here we've actually taken the thin brain limit completely. And still what you find now is that there was one mode that I mentioned earlier that was still divergent. And here, if this particular, if you use that action instead, everything is now regular. So all modes of the metric are actually have a finite propagator. Okay. So what we're working on at the moment, so of course the big question is 1/4 is not what we observe in nature, we measure in half, right, from general relativity. So the question is, how do you get from a fourth to a half? In DGP, that relied on this R star effect. So here you have to show that as well, these two extra scalars, they get strongly coupled, and that you get something like a fourth at very large distances going to a third and eventually going to a half in the neighborhood of objects. Okay, so that's what we're currently studying, this, whether there's strong coupling. And of course the big question is, and you have to take, you want to see if the gravitation is actually realized. Okay, so I showed you this Freeman equation derived by Sebrick in the DGP model, and here you could potentially derive some analogous Freeman equation, and you want to see whether it does indeed realize the gravitation. So that's the challenge. And obviously, you can do this, you can just repeat this procedure to arbitrarily large codimensions. Okay, so that's why we call it cascading. You can start from d to d minus 1, to d minus 2, to d minus 3, all the way down to 4. Okay, and those models would correspond to alpha equals 0. And indeed, the first calculations we did shows that indeed, again, the propagator is regular, and the tensor structure is ghost. So I'll end here. Thank you very much.
So you're saying you want to filter out the large-scale effects so that something, one of the opinion that might otherwise contribute to gravitation is not. Is that
right? That's correct.
So you, and the ultimate goal seems to be getting the acceleration and stuff.
So isn't that also the evolution of super-horizon modes?
In other words, there's an FF in the standard model where all these modes go, have wavelengths longer than your scale L. So
yes.
Isn't the relationship between the potentials and the overdensity damage during that effort?
I think so, but that would be modes that are still super-horizon.
But then they come back in, that damage presumably was done, and can we see the effects of it?
Well, we can't see it. We can't. So, naively, I would say those modes that... Okay, so the one effect is this L, that this filtering effect. Those are modes that are still outside. Eventually, they might come back in if CC goes away. They'll come back in, and then one can see something. What's been studied in the literature so far is really more this R star business. That is to say that near horizon scales, you get not GR, but the scalar tensor type theory. And that's the cosmological constraints on PGP that have been studied. I think that what they're really shooting for is more this effect. So modes that went outside the horizon, say during inflation or whatever, their wavelength, those that had time to come in already, their wavelength never exceeded L.
Sure.
Their wavelength never exceeded. So because they're already inside today.
They went way outside the horizon and then come back in, but at some point.
That is not the horizon.
I understand that. There's some point, but there's no reason why they couldn't have exceeded.
Well, we can talk about it later.
It's nice to test this. So, getting back to this critical efficiency, which is about 50 to 100 pulses, you must have some fossil equation, a big field that comes from your linear equation.
Yeah, if you're non R star, put that up.
You have a generalized fossil equation.
Yes.
So, the generalized fossil equation.
Yes.
So, if you look at globular clusters, outside of the edge of the galaxy, the master vibrations are 1 to 2, they don't have that many. And there are excellent places to check the gravity, because we know the velocity of dispersion, and the size, and the size of the cluster. There's a lot of things on this. So what you do is take your theory, get the cross-sign equation, and apply it to that data. But you should work out some kind of concept. If it does,
I think Gregory's answer is that because this is a nonlinear theory, you have to be able to say that, okay, if you have an object there, it has to be completely isolated up to the scale R star. But our universe, you get to the edge of our galaxy, there's still some gravity field from other stuff.
No, but that doesn't matter.
So the naive thing is that the scale at which this would kick in, this difference in my guess, is at a scale where you get linear perturbations in today's universe. So whatever, 10 megaparsecs.
What about voids?
I'm sorry?
Voids at the size of 100 megaparsecs, and they're pretty empty. So what happens to the dynamics within voids in your theory?
That's a good question. Yes, if you find two objects in the void which are separated from each other with bigger than their own R star, which could be tens of megaparsecs, then their interaction would be different from GR. So that way you could exclude things like this. such data that would be considered.
So how do you make a prediction of that?
I think what Justin answered is absolutely right. I'll just tell you in more detail if I can. Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great. Yes, we need to do an interpretation.